Okay. Good morning, everyone. And okay, ready to go. Before we start, just a couple of announcements. First of all, today's class is dedicated to the soul of Reb Avraham ben Yekusiel Yehuda, whose yahrzeit is tomorrow. It's Father Rivka, wish you a long life and only good things for the family. The Shama should have an aliyah. The soul should be elevated and generate tremendous blessing. Before we start, let me just explain this that you found on your chair. As we know that in a couple of days, we have the festival of Purim. Purim is a time of tremendous joy, and Purim very much is with an emphasis on the concept of giving. You know, the mitzvot of Purim, the good things that we do on Purim is to share with each other. There's the mitzvah of mishloach manot, to give food gifts to other people, the mitzvah of giving money to those in need. Very much tied in what we've been talking about, time management based on values, because the values have a lot to do with relationships, and that's part of the critical part of our experience to build up. So although the mitzvah on Purim is to actually give food, actual food baskets or food gifts to other people, as a symbolic mishloach manot, we thought we'd share with you a gift before Purim. Let me just explain to you, because I need it to be explained to me, because it's, you know, unless you from a certain generation, this is new stuff. But you'll notice on the card there's a barcode. If you've got a QR scanner on your smartphone, you can scan that card. If you don't have, ask anyone under 20, they'll know what you're talking about. Your child, your grandchild, someone will figure it out for you, don't worry. And if you just scan this, if you scan this barcode, you'll download a 10-minute Purim message, which I've recorded, pre-recorded. It's now on the net, and it comes down on your phone. You can download it, and you have it. And then, in the spirit of Purim, it's a postcard. Why don't you put a stamp on it and send it to someone else as well? You don't use it up. When you scan it, someone else could scan it as well, and they could hear the Purim message. So it's just a little Purim gift from Bina to you, and then from you to, hopefully, to other people. Okay, so we're working on time management based on values in the context of personal growth, right? Let's just recap. It's week four. It's time to recap just where we're up to, and then we can take it on further from where we were last week. We're talking about becoming effective, and I think I mentioned this last week. It's a great phrase from Stephen Covey. He talks about becoming effective rather than efficient. There's a very big difference between efficient and effective. Efficient means that you're quick and you can get things done very quickly, and that's great, but it's not always an effective person. An effective person is a person that has a positive impact on the surroundings, on themselves, becomes a better character. And that's in line with what we've been talking about, the concept of time management based on values. In other words, not just about managing time to become more productive or to meet outcomes, it's about managing all the different components of our life in a better way, and using it in the context of personal development, becoming a better person. So a couple of the things that we've touched on is that good time management based on values must include all parts of our life. It's got to include the physical, it's got to include the mental, the emotional, the spiritual, the psychological, whatever part of our life we have, it's all got to be managed properly, and they've all got to come together in sync and in well-balanced, in a sort of a balanced way. We've talked about that at the end of the day, we need to understand, and this is true with every personal growth course and series and concept, that we make choices. We actually choose what we do during the day. We choose our responses. We choose how to react. And because we do that, what we need to do first is to create that personal mission statement that we talked about 2 weeks ago. And the mission statement at the end of the day is our values, it's our long-term goals, our short-term goals, and it gives us the compass and the direction for where we're actually going in life so that we can manage our days every single day in accordance with those values, in the line, in the direction, in the destination of those values which we established on the personal mission statement. So, let's just recap the four quadrants. You've got them on your handouts. It's such a powerful tool. I've been working on it. I hope you've been doing your homework. I've been trying to do mine. Sometimes more successful, sometimes less, but we're all human. That's good. So we talked about the four quadrants, the first one being urgent and important and urgent. Those are the crises in life. Those are the deadlines. Those are the things that just come up every day that just must get done because they are important and they are urgent. It's what we call the quadrant of necessity, right? The second one is important but not urgent. That's quadrant two, the critical quadrant. And that's the one that's really based on values. That's the things that we do to spend time on our personal growth. Forward planning, proper planning, relationship building, to invest time to build our relationships. It's the personal growth that we do. It's the kind of things what you do every week. You dedicate this hour to come, no matter what happens. You come and you engage in something that could be beneficial to our own personal development, right? Self-study, future planning, all these things fit into quadrant two. It's called the quadrant of effectiveness. These are things that are really important, but not urgent. They don't have an immediate urgency. The third one we spoke about last week at length was not important, but urgent, and that's the interruptions, the distractions, the annoying things that most of the time come from other people and come from the outside. The apparent need to respond immediately to an email that just popped up in the middle of me doing something really important. And it's called the quadrant of deception. And the reason that it's called the quadrant of deception is because most of the time it's not really urgent. It appears to be urgent. It looks like it's urgent, but it's not really urgent. And then we talk about the not important and the not urgent. We're going to talk about that more today. And that's the time wasters, the excess sleeping in, getting lost in internet surfing, getting lost in excess TV watching or whatever the case is. Things we just procrastinate, we get lost in all these time-wasting activities, and suddenly we realize that we haven't got to those things which are urgent or important. And of course, we said last week that it's a fine line. Sometimes something can start off in quadrant two as an activity to relax or to have some sort of positive recreation, and suddenly becomes a time waster in excess, and it becomes in quadrant four. Now, what we've talked about is the challenge, right? And we're going to continue on this today because it's such an important concept. The challenge is to live mostly in quadrant two. Okay, I'm not going to put it on the board. You all have it in front of you. I think it's clear by now. The challenge is to live mainly in quadrant two. That's how we become an effective person. That's how we live by our values. Most of the time we spend in quadrant two. The problem is, how do you spend time in quadrant two when you're inundated with quadrant one? So the concept is, and this is the formula to minimize and or eradicate some of the time, quadrant three and quadrant four. Say no to quadrant three and quadrant four so that quadrant two becomes bigger. When quadrant two becomes bigger, quadrant one becomes smaller. Quadrant one, by the way, will always exist. There are always crises. There are always things that are deadlines. There are always things that are important. We can't avoid that. We have families. We have children. We have things that happen. There's health issues that pop up unexpectedly. There's all kinds of things that happen. So quadrant one will always exist. It's naive to think that we can eradicate or eliminate quadrant one. So quadrant one will exist. The point is to try and make sure that it's kept to a minimum. And the way that happens is to make sure that quadrant two is bigger. When quadrant two is bigger, quadrant two is smaller. To make quadrant two bigger, we've got to say no to quadrant three and four. But as we said last week, you can only say no to quadrant three and quadrant four if you've got a very big yes burning in you. In other words, the values, your mission statement has become very clear. That suddenly your relationships, your health, your personal growth, the things that are important, your values, your spirituality, whatever your quadrant two is, becomes burningly important, becomes really important, and you dedicate it to it. You become committed to your quadrant two. You become committed to making time, to designating time, to making sure that there are hours in the week that we dedicate to things that are based on our values, which then motivate us and drive us to say no to quadrant three and quadrant four. That's a clear formula, right? Everyone's with us? Yep. Stephen Covey has a great line. He talks about the urgent and the important. He says, when are we going to stop swatting flies all day and start fixing the hole in the screen door. That's it. And that's what it's all about. So often we run around all day swatting flies. And they're important. They're annoying. They're urgent. And we just don't make sure to stop to designate time to fix the hole in the screen door so that the flies don't come in the first place. Now, last week we spoke more about saying no to quadrant three. So quadrant three are those annoying distractions that come from the outside. And we said the problem why we get stuck in quadrant three is a few things. One is that we have this concept of control. So we need to control that which is outside of us, which we've spoken about so many times, which becomes a real problem. And we need to learn to let go. We need to learn that we don't have to answer the phone. We need to learn that we don't have to answer that email. We need to learn that we can't turn the phone off. We can't turn the function on the computer off that won't make those emails pop up all the time. And together with that, the second concept is we just need to learn to say no. No, by the way, is a proactive word. It's not a bad word. It depends how you say it, of course. But no can be a good word. No means I make time for other people. The fundamentals of personal growth is to make time for others, but in a proactive, constructive way, right? And sometimes we just need to be able to say no. It's a very difficult thing for a person to do because, as we said last week, we define ourselves so much by popularity, by how other people perceive us, and therefore it's so difficult to say no to others because then you will think that I was nasty, I was unkind, I wasn't compassionate, I wasn't able to make time for you. Now, of course, if I can make time and I can go out of my way, that's what I should do. But sometimes it just comes as an immediate distraction, interruption in the middle of my quadrant two stuff that got derailed. I never get to the quadrant two because I'm not able to be disciplined and say no. No is a very important word and we need to learn how to say it. And sometimes we need to do it by various things. We didn't speak about this so much last week, but there's so many tools that we could use to say no to quadrant three. And that is, we need to create systems. You know, we need to create systems of when we do the things that sometimes we need to attend to distractions. We need to answer those calls. We need to answer those emails. But we can designate times to do that and they can wait a little bit. We need to learn to create effective boundaries by other people. You know, there's people that will stop you anytime, any place. You got a minute? You got 10 minutes? I really need to speak to you, right? It's about creating those boundaries. It's about saying sometimes, I do have time. I've got 5 minutes. What do you want to discuss in this 5 minutes? You know, it's got 17 things to discuss. Prioritize three of them that we can make happen in the 5 minutes and stick to it. By the way, saying no and then becoming wishy-washy and then getting off rail is like saying no 17 times to a child and they know that no actually means yes, it just takes a bit more time. Right? You know what I mean? It's like a different kind of yes, it just takes more time. But that's fine. But no has to mean no. It doesn't have to be aggressive. It doesn't have to be in a nasty way. It can be a firm, respectful, positive no, but no has to say no. It's about setting boundaries and saying, I'd love to talk to you, but can we do it in an hour? You know, in an hour I'll have time, right now. Or it's about not taking that call. It's just that ability to learn to say no. It's a very, very hard thing. Now, let's have a look now at habit four, because we talked about saying no to habit three, and hopefully you practiced that a bit. Let's talk about saying no to quadrant four.
Let's get a better one.
Okay, let's just recap here. Quadrant four is the not important, not urgent. Okay, I've given some examples. You give me some examples of quadrant four. Let's just talk about what quadrant four could be. Don't be shy. Okay, so excess. We talked about excess television, right? Anything else? Give me an example of time wasters. You don't have to tell me how you waste time. Tell me how your friend wastes time.
Computer.
Okay. That's a one or two more.
Talking on the phone.
Okay. Endless phone calls, right?
Maybe not delegating stuff that you could delegate.
Ah. Right. Doing stuff that you don't need to do. Someone else could do it. That's a bit of a crossover between quadrant three and quadrant four. In other words, you think it's because the reason why you're doing it yourself could be because you think it's urgent. And you think it's important, but it's also quadrant four, it's a time waster. And by the way, that has a lot to do with control, just because you can't give it to someone else, because you think, I have to be able to do it, because if someone else does it, of course they're not going to do it as well as me, and therefore I've got to do everything. So it's, let's put it here, not delegating. It can be in either one, really. So, there's a whole range of things that fall into quadrant four, and a lot of them are real time wasters. Just the idea of procrastinating. Some people are just by nature or by habit, depending on the circumstance, procrastinators, right? It's actually a disease. There's a whole study done about it. Procrastination. Okay. So, let's understand why people get stuck in quadrant four. Okay. Quadrant four has nothing to do most of the time with other people. It's not that I can't say no because I'm worried that you're going to have a bad impression of me. Quadrant four is my own time wasting stuff. Now, of course, it's a general lack of discipline. But, you know, we're not all lazy. And yet we all get stuck in quadrant four plenty of time. Laziness is a funny term anyways. It's very, very misinterpreted. Sometimes we call people lazy and the word is wrong. It's not lazy. Because you see sometimes people who can be very lazy in certain things and yet not lazy at all when it comes to the things that they have an interest in, right? Or it comes to things that they believe they can do well. So there are people that are just generally lazy, but here we're not talking about laziness. We're talking about people that can be very effective and can get things done and work hard when they need to or when they want to, and yet seem to get stuck in quadrant four and just don't get to the things that are important. Now, quadrant four is a terrible quadrant because what happens is the more we spend here, the smaller quadrant two becomes, because we never get to it, and the bigger quadrant one becomes because the crises grow, right? The crises grow tremendously when we get stuck in quadrant four. And the question is, why do we get stuck in quadrant four? Why do we get stuck in that time-wasting activity? It's easy. It is easy, correct. And because it's easy, the reason that we get stuck there is, it's really the quadrant of escape. That's what it is. Right? We escape into quadrant four. And we escape into quadrant four for a whole host of reasons. Right? We escape at the quadrant four because either we don't have a mission statement, so therefore we actually don't have a compass. We don't have a direction. We don't have values. We don't even know where we're going, so we're confused, and therefore it's all ad hoc. So the first step to getting stuck in quadrant four is when we live an ad hoc lifestyle, where we actually don't know where we're going. So going back to our mission statement session, the first step to not getting stuck in quadrant four is to have that mission statement. It is so important to actually have a focus, to know where you're going overall, to know what you want to look like when you're 100, and translate that into what I want to look like at the end of the year, at the end of 10 years, at the end of the month. Right? So have a focus. A focus creates a drive. When we have a focus, we are more motivated. Focus creates motivation. So the first reason we get stuck here is because we don't have that mission statement. But even if we do have a mission statement, we still tend to get stuck in quadrant four. And the reason for that is because we are scared of quadrant two. Why are we scared of quadrant two? Because human beings, mostly, are terrified of failing. Terrified of failing. Right? Now, it is in the extreme when it comes to a person who's a perfectionist. And perfectionism is a pathology. Right? I know that some of us suffer from it, but it's really a problem. Perfectionism is just an extreme expression of this paralysis that a person puts themselves into, that everything they do must be absolutely perfect. A lot of the time it has to do with the image of how I'm portrayed. A lot of time it has to do with the self-definition. I don't want to be defined. I don't want to define myself as someone who fails. I don't want to find myself as someone who does things incorrectly, inappropriately. And therefore, we are terrified of the important things in life. Because we're terrified we won't do it right. We're terrified to invest time in building our relationships. Because consciously or subconsciously, maybe it won't work. And maybe we try to put time into our relationships and it doesn't go right. And I try to build a relationship with my teenager and then suddenly we have a crisis where there's a blow-up. And whatever the relationship is, we're terrified to do it. We're terrified to work on our personal growth because we have that sense of failure. So let's say I try not to lose my temper and then it works two times and then it just goes out the window. I read all the parenting books and I'm a good parent for 3 days and suddenly it all goes out the window. I'm a failure. We're scared of failure. We're scared to do things wrong. Now, of course, the problem with that is that it's all outcome-based and externally based. And from a Jewish perspective, we've talked about this so many times, that is fundamentally wrong. It's fundamentally wrong because, particularly in Jewish thought, the reward, the value is placed on growth and direction and not perfection. I've told you this many times, that when the Torah says that that God will reward people for studying, it doesn't say, I'll reward you for studying many volumes. It says, I will reward you for studying with effort. The person who needs a lot of effort to study one page of whatever they're studying and spends 2 hours trying to master that one page has exactly the same value, if not more, than the person who spends the same effort on mastering 10 pages. That person's just brighter. It's a God-given talent. That's different to the way things work in society. In society, very often things work outcome-based. You're a success if you reach the goal. The journey on the way is irrelevant almost. Right? If you don't finish medical school, if you didn't pass the exam, you're not a doctor. It's very simple. Now, it has its place. I mean, you don't want to go to a doctor with a lot of effort and doesn't know the medical stuff, right? So, maybe that's a good idea. But the problem is, right? It's not only a doctor, you don't want an electrician, you know, that really put a lot of hard work into studying electronics. But really doesn't know which wire to put where. I mean, you know. So, of course, when it comes to things that need to get done, you need certain people. It doesn't make the person who put effort and doesn't know electronics less valuable. It just means he shouldn't be an electrician. He's misplaced his talent, right? But from a Jewish point of view, this is such an important thing because the core identity of a person has nothing to do with what you achieve at the end of the day. It's got to do with the growth. Are you better today than you were yesterday? Did you put in effort to become better today than you put in yesterday? More than you put in yesterday? That's success. And so often, we have this problem where we actually are scared to get into quadrant two because we don't want to mess it up. So subconsciously or even consciously sometimes we just ignore it. We ignore all the important things because it's easier just to ignore them. It's much easier to slip into all the time wasted of quadrant four. It's a great escape. We get there, the world is bliss, everything is fine, we've shut out the whole world until the crisis happens. We'd have no choice. Until the absolute crisis happens, then we have no choice. We have to deal with it, and normally we deal with it ineffectively. Now, of course, part of that erroneous way of thinking, where we think of outcome rather than growth and rather than effort, is that another reason that we get stuck in quadrant two is because in quadrant four, because we're overwhelmed by quadrant two because we have unrealistic expectations. Right? Unrealistic expectations. We've decided that we come to a time management course, we've talked about quadrant two, we have a mission statement with values, so we're now going to switch gear and we're going to put in hours and hours in personal growth or parenting or investing in our relationships. And of course it doesn't work, it's not practical. Sometimes we set ourselves goals that are just much, much too difficult to achieve. We become scared of them, we become overwhelmed with the enormity of those expectations, and we give up and we slip back into quadrant four. So therefore, part of getting out of quadrant four requires a few different things. Number one, it requires realistic expectations. Number two, it requires a thinking where we place value on effort and growth rather than outcome. I've said this to you many times, if we invest effort into something and we improve just a little bit, and then we fall back, that little bit is valuable, that little bit is eternal, that little bit is success, so we need to celebrate that success. And each little bit that we do counts. And sometimes when we procrastinate, and sometimes we just can't get to something because it seems like a huge task, one of the practical strategies that I once heard in a time-managed video, which I always remember, it always rings in my mind, is something that I've forgotten even who the presenter was, but he called it the salami method. And the salami method is, just like when you serve salami, you don't serve a whole chunk of salami, you cut it up into small pieces. Right? Sometimes we need to play tricks with our own mind. If we've got an enormous task to do, if we've got something that's really important, but we know it's difficult. It's difficult because it really is difficult, or it's difficult because we just don't want to do it. It's difficult because we think we're going to fail, whatever the reason is. What we need to do is to cut it up into very, very small sizes. And to say, you know what, I'm not going to spend an hour on this. I'm going to spend 7 minutes on it. Today, there's a quadrant two activity that I want to spend 7 minutes with. When I come home, when my child comes, when my grandchild comes, I'm going to spend 5 minutes playing. I'm not going to take him to the park for 7 hours. I'm going to do 5 minutes. Because 5 minutes is manageable. I'm not so scared of it. If I convince myself that 5 minutes is valuable and it's a success, I will do it. The Talmud tells us, kol hatchalot kashot. Whenever you begin something, it's difficult. The beginning is always hardest. The beginning is the most crucial, and the beginning is the hardest. Why is the beginning the hardest? Because we haven't tasted any success yet. And we're scared of the enormity, we're scared of failing, we're scared of the task, it may be too difficult, I don't know if I can do it, maybe not for me. We need just to make a start. We need to promise ourselves 5 minutes, and when the 5 minutes is over, I can go back to quadrant four. Today. The chances are that once you do the 5 minutes, one or two things will happen. If you do the 5 minutes, and you succeed, and you go back to quadrant four, you didn't fail. You didn't complete. You're nowhere near where you should be, but you've grown. You've spent 5 minutes on quadrant two. So you don't feel like a failure because you set yourself a realistic expectation and you did it. But the chances are that when you get into 5 minutes of a quadrant two activity, you will then extend it to 10 minutes or to 15 minutes. If not today, it will be tomorrow, because success breeds success. The feeling of being quadrant two is amazing. You see, these four quadrants all come with different emotions. And I'm sure you can imagine what they are. You know, quadrant one is sort of panic, anxiety, it's urgent, it's crisis. Right? Quadrant four normally comes with emotions of emptiness, an empty shell, like just no direction, apathy, complacency, you just, no drive. Quadrant two, whenever we do something that's in quadrant two, you would know yourself, there's a tremendous feeling of stimulation, of satisfaction, of meaning, of purpose. When you taste that feeling, you want more. You're scared to go there. But if you just start, we make a start. The salami method, one little piece. Today I'm going to have one little piece of trying to dedicate time for quadrant two. That brings amazing success. It brings the feeling of fulfillment. And we'll want more tomorrow. We'll do more and we'll taste more. So, we need to set realistic expectations. We need to take small chunks and just start. And we need to understand the thinking that it's not about being perfect. It's okay to fail. If I do a quadrant two and I do fail, that's fine. I'll try again tomorrow. It's about putting in the effort. That's called success, and that's rewarding. If we do have that mindset, then we sort of move away from quadrant four and get more into quadrant two. Now, what I really want to focus on is a concept which we've touched on before, but I want to develop it even more today. And it's really perhaps the number one cause of why we get stuck in quadrant four. But it's a concept that is at the very core, really, of time management. If this is just one thing we could take aboard, it's worth the whole thing, what I'm going to share with you now. And it's not only related to time management, it is critical, and it's the foundation of time management, really, or successful time management. But it also goes to the core of many, many, many areas of life. Just life in general. And this concept will explain why it is so often that we become frazzled, we get confused, we lose focus, and what happens is when life becomes too overwhelming and everything seems to be coming at us and we're swatting flies all day, we kind of don't know where to go and we slip into quadrant four. And it stops us from being dedicated to those quadrant two value-based things. And that is, it's the concept of living in the moment. That's such an important idea that I want to spend the rest of today developing this idea. We've talked about this before, and let's just define this first of all. What we're talking about is living, what I call living in the moment, but not for the moment. Okay, they're two very different things. Living for the moment is a terrible thing. We don't live for the moment, we live for our mission, we live for our overall values, right? In the Torah, we have the story of Esav, Jacob's brother, Esau, the evil Esau, who came home one day and we know that Yaakov was, a famous story, Yaakov was cooking lentils because his grandfather had died and there was a house of mourning and Yitzchak, Isaac, was eating lentils because he was mourning after his father Abraham. And Esav walked in, this wild Esav walks in and he's hungry. And he sees Yaakov cooking this red, delicious soup. And he says, pour it down my throat. So Yaakov seizes the moment and he says, listen, you have something I want. Now I'm not going to go into what this all means now because that's a separate shiur, but he says, you have the birthright. The birthright, because he was the older twin. And you have the birthright, I want the bechara, I want the birthright. So look at Esau's response. Esau's response is, I'm going to die tomorrow anyways, who cares about the birthright? Which he later regretted and he complained why it was taken away from him. He says, today I'm hungry, today I want food, give me the food and let me move on, let me eat and be merry. Right? That's not called living in the moment, that's called living for the moment. Living for the moment is a very destructive thing. We don't live for the moment. We live for a mission. We live aspiring towards the direction of our compass. But what is critical is not to live for the moment, but to live in the moment. What does that mean? So let's develop this and draw some inspiration from Purim. Everything's by divine providence. This coming Sunday is Purim, Festival of Purim. And we'll try and take some inspiration from Purim to understand this idea. There are two important concepts we have to consider when we talk about living in the moment. Right? Now, by the way, most people don't live in the moment. Right? Most people, what happens is, we're so rushed, right? And we're so pressured, that we're in three places at once, normally. What do I mean with three places at once? What we're doing, normally, we do something. You see, the person is made up of multi layers. We're made up of our intellect, our emotion, our behavior. Right? Let's divide into those three for the moment. Very, very often, when we're doing something, when we're doing an activity, we're doing that activity, but we're not fully present. Meaning, we're present on the level of behavior. Our intellect is in the past. We're thinking about what someone said to me. What happened yesterday? Why were things went wrong? What could have gone better? Our emotions are very often in the future. That could be the other way around. In other words, we're worried about tomorrow. I'm nervous about catching that plane. I'm nervous about the meeting I have to have tomorrow. I'm nervous about the confrontation or the conference that I might have to have this evening. Right? So we're in three places at once. That is the most destructive force to managing our time effectively and giving it meaning and purpose. And the two things we have to consider is this. That when we live a life of purpose and meaning, there are two things we have to realize. Number one, there's nothing that has more importance than something else. What do I mean? See, if we manage our day, and our day is managed according to our mission statement, so whatever we do is based on our values. Now, whatever we do based on our values is a very diverse set of activities. Right? Because values dictate that number one has a place, so we need to respond to those things as well. Values dictate that sometimes we need to do things that are a means to an end, but it's an end to get to our values. So therefore, it might mean washing a dish or taking out the garbage. It's part of our day. The things that we don't particularly enjoy. Or it can be things which are really valuable, like studying. Like in relationship time building, etc. But when we have a mission statement, when we have values, when we have a direction, and everything we do ultimately moves towards that direction, including the recreation that we do, including the relaxation, including the vacations, including the things that we take care of ourselves and others, whatever it is, menial, important. Everything that we do becomes incredibly important. And everything that we do, therefore, when we do it and when we have to do it, needs to be the most important thing in our entire life. In other words, when we do something, we need to learn to become present in what we're doing completely. It doesn't matter how important or how not important it is. If it's part of your mission statement, if it will get you closer to your life values, then it's important. If it's important right now, nothing else matters. And it's like the most important thing that ever existed. You know, in the Torah, there's a concept. We have a Torah scroll, which is made up of over 300,000 letters. It's an amazing idea. And we know that the Torah scroll, if you go into synagogue, you know the Torah is very holy. It's kept in an ark, and it's kissed when it comes out, and it's a sacred piece, right? What gives us this holiness? Its holiness is because it has every single letter, right? Now, if one letter from the Torah is missing, we know the entire Torah is invalid. You can't use it, it loses its holiness. Does it make a difference which letter it is? Now, I know if you look in the Torah, if you look in the Chumash, you'll notice there's many, many different types of words. There are words like the Shema. Now, Shema, we know, is it's the core of Judaism. It's the holiest sentence, perhaps. Jews have lived, died, done everything, educated children with the line of the Shema. And then you have verses in the Torah that, you know, talk about, the children of Esav. For whatever reason, God wanted us to know the family history, the family tree of Esav. So we know that his grandson was called Eliphaz. So you have the word Eliphaz in the Torah. Now, can you compare the word Eliphaz to Shema Israel? Of course not. And yet, it makes no difference which Aleph is missing from the Torah that makes it all invalid. Because if it needs to be there, it has equal importance. So the Aleph of Eliphaz or the Aleph of Israel in the Shema are equally important. They might not be equally as holy. They might not be equally as lofty. They might represent different things. But in terms of the validity, the kashrut of the Torah scroll, in terms of its holiness, they're equally important. And our life is a bit like that. If something we do belongs, then it's incredibly important. It's as important as something tremendously spiritual or holy, if it belongs. If it's got to do with our purpose, if it doesn't lead to our values, then we should try and get rid of it. If it's in quadrant 4, then really we should try eliminate it. But if it belongs to our values, it's a standalone, important, amazing thing. That's the first point. The second thing to consider, and you'll see where this all comes back to how we get out of quadrant 4. The first thing to consider is this. The second thing to think about is the following. That when you do something important, that particular activity is a complete standalone, which means it's a piece of the puzzle of your overall goal, but in itself, it's absolutely eternal. Good, we've talked about this once before, good is eternal. What you do now is not affected, weakened, destroyed, undermined by anything that happened till now, and is certainly not affected by anything that's going to happen tomorrow. If I do something valuable now, that what I did that is valuable is holy, it's beautiful, it's eternal, and it's got nothing to do with what I did yesterday, and it's got nothing to do with what I did tomorrow. It's got nothing to do with what I did last hour, and it's got nothing to do with what I might do in an hour from now. And that's true in everything in life, which has got to do with what we talked about before, about understanding the definition of success. So if I succeed in doing something well now, the fact that in an hour from now I fail, that doesn't undermine what I did now. Now that's an incredibly critical, important idea, because so often we're not present in what we're doing now because we're carrying guilt or we're upset about what happened yesterday, and therefore we're just unable to concentrate, unable to focus. We're not able to live in the moment because what I'm doing now cannot be that valuable because look what I did yesterday. I'm now a worse person. I've messed up. I'm carrying the whole world's load on my shoulders in my brain, and therefore what I do now just doesn't deserve my focus, just doesn't get my full attention. Or I'm nervous about what's about to happen, because what's about to happen might undermine me as well, and therefore it affects what I'm doing now. But if we understand the value of each thing that we do, if everything that we do is important, what I do now has nothing to do with what I did before, what I'm going to do afterwards, with how successful I was before, or successful I was afterwards. And when we understand that, then we give incredible eternal value to the present, and we're able to fully focus on what happens now and completely filter out what's happened till now and what's going to happen in the future. That doesn't mean, by the way, I have to forget what happens last hour. Because if I messed up last hour, if I had a fight with someone, if I did something wrong, if I was a failure, if I broke something, there's a time that I'll deal with it. But it's got nothing to do with what I'm doing now. I have to decide. Either now's a time that I deal with what happened last hour, in which case I'm not doing what I'm doing now, or it's a time that I forget about what happened and I'll do it later, but now I'm fully in the present. So often we get stuck in quadrant 4 because we get frazzled and we just give up. Why? Things aren't going to plan. So what I was supposed to do at 10 o'clock didn't happen, and now the thing comes 11 o'clock, but the 10 o'clock hasn't happened, so I really haven't been successful. My day's haywire anyways. I'm full of chaos. It's a big challenge. So forget it. I'm going to watch TV. Come out. It's easier.
A New Earth.
A New Earth by Eckhart Tolle. I've seen it. I haven't read it. I've seen it.
It's all about living in the moment, in the present.
Okay. That's it. So, let me share with you an amazing story. And that's one of the main reasons we get stuck in quadrant four, because we just can't cope with the past and the future, so the present is distracted. Let me share with you an extreme story of this. It's a story that comes from the Jerusalem Talmud with an explanation from the Leif Simcha, which is one of the Hasidic rebbes of the dynasty of Ger, the Ger Hasidim. The story is told of two great rabbis. Sorry, let me just find it. Here we are. Two great rabbis called Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, who they were on the way to the public bathhouse. That's what it says. And on towards the entrance of the bathhouse, that was the culture in those days, people used to take baths in public bathhouses. They happened to be going at the same time. They're walking together, obviously discussing maybe some halachic issue together. And they approached the bathhouse, and suddenly they were approached by what appeared to be a beggar, who put out his hand and asked him for money. Tzedakah, charity, which they were willing to give. But they said to him, no problem, you're here anyways. Let's go, we'll go take a bath, and when we finish, when we come out, we'll help you. They came out, and the guy died. Now listen to this. The guy died. So the immediate reaction would have been, we didn't realize he was that hungry. If we're not that hungry, obviously we would have given him money before we went in, right? So they come out and they don't give him, and they see that he's died. So a normal person would have been absolutely guilt-ridden and fallen apart and just not known what to do with themselves, carrying this burden, this guilt of maybe indirectly we were responsible for someone dying. And listen to what they did. Listen to how proactive they were. Now you see the end of the story, they didn't need to have guilt, but at that moment they could have had guilt and they would have probably planned to deal with it later. But at that moment, they turned to each other and they said the following. They said, since we didn't get the opportunity to help this person when he was alive, let's at least help him in this present situation. And they got together people to have to give him the proper dignity. They arranged a proper dignified burial for him. They got a large crowd to be at the funeral, so to perform the mitzvah of accompanying the dead. And the Leif Simcha, the Ger Rebbe, explains that this is the most amazingly powerful idea. Because most people would do exactly what we just described. They'd fall apart by the past, and they would end up not doing what is important now. When they walked out of the bathhouse and they saw a person who didn't seem to have relatives, who had dropped dead, who was now no longer living, the call of the hour was to spring into action and to do something purposeful. At that moment, the purposeful thing to do was to arrange him a dignified, respectful, Jewish proper burial. That was all. Now, if they needed to feel guilty, maybe they did. And maybe it was the wrong thing they didn't give him money. There's a time and place for that. Come home, they'll reflect on the day, and then they'll do tshuva and they'll repent. But at that moment, they completely filtered out the past and focused completely on the present. The end of the story is a beautiful story. Well, not a beautiful story, but the end of the story is that they didn't need to have guilt, because when they were undressing him and preparing him for the burial, they found that he had pockets full of money. See, right? So it actually wasn't from, like, it was obviously not a well person, and therefore it wasn't actually their fault. They had nothing to do tshuva for, really. They didn't even have to feel guilty later on. But they didn't know that at the time, right? And yet they were able to filter out the past and just focus on the future. Now, it's hard to do in such situations, but at least we can learn from that. We can learn from that when things haven't gone right, whatever went wrong last hour needs to be dealt with. But if I need to do something now, I need to learn that art of filtering out the past and just focusing it completely in the future. You know, in the story of Purim, let's take inspiration from Purim. In the story of Purim, we find that part of the story was that Haman was going to annihilate the Jewish people, and then he was called to the banquet of Esther and then Achashverosh, etc. And if you know the story, what happens at the end was that he was very, very arrogant, and he started to have his downfall, where the king told him to take a horse and to parade Mordechai around the city of Shushan, right? That's the story. And it was a moment of Mordechai's glory. And the commentaries point out an interesting thing, that when Mordechai was being paraded around the city of Shushan, he felt good, not in an arrogant way, but he rejoiced and he celebrated because he saw hope. He saw optimism. He saw that evil was about to have a downfall and that holiness was on the way up. But the commentaries point out that the truth is that at that moment, the Tsaris was very far from over. Haman was still alive. The decree to kill the Jewish people was still in force. So the weight that Mordechai carried as a leader of the Jewish nation was still very heavy. But that wasn't for them. There was a moment that God had sent him to enjoy, to feel the victory of good over evil. He was fully absorbed and was able to fully concentrate on that moment. But there's something talking about Purim, there's something even more profound than that. And that is a Medrash. The Medrash talks about Esther. The Medrash quotes a verse that talks about the value of doing every small mitzvah. And there's a pasuk, I think it's from Psalms, from Tehillim, where it says, Shomer mitzvah lo yodea davara, that if someone is engaged in something, doing something good, it's a protection from evil. And the Medrash says, what's an example of someone that does something good? And it's a really left-field example. The example that Medrash gives is Esther. You know what, Esther? She did good things. You know what she did according to the Medrash? You know, there's a mitzvah the night before Pesach to search for chametz. Right? Take a candle, you search for chametz. One of the mitzvahs. One of the small details of mitzvah when it comes to Pesach. Now we know from the Talmud and from the Gemara that Esther had a big problem. When she was in the palace, she didn't reveal her identity as a Jewess, but yet tried very, very hard to observe the mitzvot to the best of her ability. And to the point where even it came the night before Pesach, she searched for chametz. So the commentaries say, this is absurd. Esther was living in this palace full of chametz, right? No one cared about the mitzvah of chametz or matzah or Pesach. No one even knew she was Jewish. There were people around. She had a retinue of servants and then all kinds of people all around. So maybe in her little chamber, in her little compartment where she slept, maybe she was able to clean it for Pesach to the best of her ability without anyone getting to find out, and she searched for chametz. What value does that have when a whole environment was not Pesach Day? The whole environment was just not kosher and not conducive to celebrating the festival of Passover. And here again, the same concept, the commentaries explain the same idea. The same idea is that it doesn't matter what's happening in the bigger picture. If you're able to accomplish something small, if in your little world, in your little day, in your hour, if I'm right now able to do something positive, that's all that counts. What happened before, what happened afterwards, what's around me, what's next door. If I can light one candle in this darkness, the candle pushes away a lot of light. Esther knew that it's not within her reach to transform her house to Pesach. Spiritually, in other words, spiritually what that means is she was never able to transform her own whole environment to something which was holy. But she knew she could do her immediate surroundings. It's a small part of the big puzzle, but it's valuable and it's eternal. It's the same idea. Living in the moment means we're not affected by the past or the future. We filter it out. But we are focused on what we can do now. And what we can do now is eternal and needs our full attention and our full presence to become the most effective thing that we can do. Someone shared with me yesterday something from Thomas Leonard, and he said, being in sync with your present is just about the best way to optimize the future. It's a great line. Let me tell you a story. The Lubavitcher Rebbe once had a gathering, a Fabrengen, and it was in honor of a group of people who had come from Israel to visit him. It was back in the early days, there was a whole group that had come for a particular occasion, I'm not sure what it was. And to farewell them, he held a special gathering just a few hours before they were going to catch a flight. And he kept talking, and it got a bit late, and it was getting towards the time when they had to go to the airport. And as the Fabrengen progressed, they wouldn't walk out of respect. But the Rebbe noticed that group increasingly were looking at the clock. Because, you know, it was getting late. So he stopped and he smiled and he told them a story. He said in the mid-1920s, in the darkest days of communist Russia, he was with his father-in-law, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, who was being watched every moment by the KGB under communist rule because they knew that he was active in Jewish activity, and they're just waiting for the moment they could pounce on him. And he knew this weight on his head the whole time. He said, he told the story, he said, late one night, he said, I entered my father-in-law's study in his Leningrad apartment. and he had just been working a whole night to be receiving people, counseling people, blessing people. And in a few hours, he had to go to the train station to catch a train where he was going to have a very important and dangerous meeting with someone in St. Petersburg, in Moscow, I mean. And he said, I walked in, and he was sitting at his desk, just working, organizing his papers, studying, as if it was the middle of a regular day. And he said, in amazement, I turned to my father and I said, how can you be so calm? He said, I know that Hasidic philosophy teaches that your mind must rule your heart and you've got to be in control of your emotions, but to such an extent, you've been working so hard the whole night that in a few hours you must be terribly nervous about this dangerous mission you're about to embark on, and you're working calmly at your desk as if nothing has happened. So he said, my father-in-law replied the following. He said, we cannot make our days longer, nor can we add additional hours to our nights, but we can maximize our usage of time by regarding each segment of time as a world of its own. When we devote a portion of time, whether it's an hour, a day, or even a minute, to a certain task, we should be totally invested in what we are doing, as if there exists nothing else in the world. That is the key to getting out of quadrant 4 and getting into quadrant 2. Once a great Hasidic Rebbe once saw someone running. I don't know who it was, it's quoted in the name of someone. And he said to him, my son, where are you running? He said, I'm running to make a living. So he told him, he says, that's nice, but how do you know that your livelihood is in front of you? Maybe it's behind you. Right? You know, we spend the life, we're always running. We're running from one thing to another. We're on one thing to another, one task to another. We need to slow down. We need to have a direction. We need to have a mission statement. We need to understand that every segment, everything that we do is important. And even if things haven't gone right, if we have a quadrant 2 waiting for us here, and the day's been an absolute disaster, or we've been responding to number 1 or crisis, but we have an opportunity to spend 50 minutes and we're not in the mood, let's learn the art of filtering out the past, forget about what's happening tonight, and let's fully focus on what we're doing. And that's how we increase the activity of quadrant 2. And that when quadrant 2 becomes bigger, quadrant 1 becomes smaller. And let me just finish by telling you your homework for the week. So here it is. Take one thing in quadrant 2. Take something you know you should be doing and you haven't been doing it, right? And schedule 15 minutes in the middle of the day. No, 10 minutes, 5 minutes. Schedule some time, even when you know it's going to be busy. And just do it. And in those 5 minutes, live in the moment. Just forget about everything. The world will still be there. Your problems will still be there, I promise you, when you come back. Just forget about everything. Transport yourself to that world. And just fully be in that moment. And let me just mention one thing before you run away. Just for those who can make it again, Sunday is Purim. At 10:15, we have a little Purim tea here with a bit of inspiration. The Megillah will be read at 9:45 on Sunday morning upstairs. And I want to just wish you all a very happy Purim. And don't forget to listen to your Purim message on your postcard and send it to a friend. Have a great day.